The Guardian.
Before we get started with this edition of Politics Weekly, we want to point you in the direction of our sponsor, Squarespace. Squarespace's award-winning templates are the most beautiful way to present your ideas online. Head to squarespace.com and enter the offer code POLITICSWEEKLY to get 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. Squarespace. Make your next move. Make your next website.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Heather Stewart. Last summer, every week seemed to bring more grim news of desperate refugees drowned in the Med as they fled war in Syria and elsewhere to seek safety in Europe. Flows of refugees to Europe have slowed from a peak in 2015, and the issue has for now dropped down the political agenda. But thousands of people have crossed the Mediterranean already this year, and just last week, 11 people drowned off the coast of Turkey. And campaigners reacted furiously last month when the Home Office announced that Britain would end its commitment to provide a safe haven for what had been expected to be thousands of refugee children. The agreement, following the intervention of Lord Dubs, himself once a refugee from Nazi Germany, was halted after just 350 children had been resettled. It's a hugely emotive debate, but is there a solution that goes further than just political sticking plasters? And are the current international institutions up to the job? Joining me now to discuss it all are the authors of a new book, Refuge, Oxford professors Alexander Betts and Paul Collier, and The Guardian's Kate Lyons, commissioning editor of a major new Guardian series on refugees called The New Arrivals. Paul, as I said, the numbers crossing the Med have dropped from hundreds of thousands to tens of thousands. That's largely down to the deal between the EU and Turkey, isn't it? Is this the kind of deal that should be extended to other countries and other conflicts, do you think?
The fact that the numbers are low also tells you something about what refugees want. Most refugees don't want to come to Britain, or indeed don't want to come to anywhere in Europe. Most refugees actually want to go home. That's why most Syrian refugees stayed in the havens, the regional havens close to Syria. Only a tiny proportion of Syrians have actually come to Europe, but half the Syrian population is displaced. The people who fled Syria fled to Jordan, to Turkey, to Lebanon. And we've vastly over-focused on the relative handful that have come here. We spend £100 for every refugee that makes it to Europe for less than £1 we spend on a refugee who stays in a safe haven.
So this political focus of campaigners, which is on we must open our doors here, we must bring people here, that's not necessarily the right thing for those people. That's not what those people want.
It's not what they want. It's not our duty of rescue. Our duty of rescue to refugees should be something that unites the whole nation. And our primary duty of refuge is to restore normality. You restore normality by giving people the dignity of being able to earn a living and have some autonomy. At the moment, the international model for refugees, what's being on offer and has been on offer for over 50 years, is free food, free shelter in a camp. Refugees are left to rot. What they want is to have the freedom, the autonomy, the dignity of earning a living, which is why, overwhelmingly, most refugees, although they stay in the regional havens as a matter of choice, they don't go to the camps. They go to the cities to try and find work. And the tragedy is that that's illegal.
And Alexander, part of the reason we have this system, the camp system, is because probably in the public's mind and in some politicians' mind, we're talking about something quite temporary, aren't we? You imagine you go to a camp, you take haven there for 6 months or a year or 2 years, and then you go back and you resume your life. But that's very much not the reality of it, is it?
Refugee camps continue to be the default response of the international humanitarian system. And they're perfectly valid for the emergency phase. They provide basic needs, basic security, food, clothing, shelter. The tragedy is they endure year after year. People end up in camps for on average nearly 2 decades. And so we get children born in camps, growing up in camps, becoming adults in camps. The Dadaab camps in northern Kenya, for instance, host 350,000 Somalis. And many of them have been there since they were opened in 1992. 100,000 people have been born into that camp environment. When we remember that people people rarely have the right to work in camps, rarely have freedom of movement. These are like warehouses. They're essentially imprisoning people and denying them dignity, denying them hope. And what we need to work towards is transforming that model to allow people the right to work, freedom of movement, basic socioeconomic rights. Because in the few instances where we see that around the world, in countries like Uganda, it not only benefits refugees, it can benefit the host societies.
And tell us how it works in Uganda. That's an example you talk about in the book, isn't it?
Uganda's a fascinating model. It's got what's called a self-reliance strategy. And even though it has around 1 million refugees now, it gives them plots of land in rural areas so they can cultivate and they can contribute to the agricultural economy. And in cities, they're allowed to set up businesses and work. And they contribute. For instance, we collected data at Oxford University and we showed that in the capital, Kampala, 21% of refugees run a business that employs at least one other person. And of the people they employ, 40% are host nationals. In other words, refugees are making jobs. The problem is that not every country is Uganda. Not everyone has a surplus of arable land that they can give to refugees or the ability to sustain that democratically. So we need to be more innovative when we look to other countries that have greater constraints, greater political constraints, often because of the democratic will of the population, to restrict the right to work and those basic economic freedoms.
And those economic freedoms, we try and maintain a difference, don't we, between what we call an economic migrant and a refugee. And perhaps some people's worry would be that you allied those two things if you allow refugees to work or if you think things in a different way. How do we maintain that separation? Is that a bit of a nonsense, that idea?
But refugees are not migrants. Most of them, as we say, are not trying to come here. They're trying to find...
Just getting away from something, not heading towards something.
And so in Jordan, there was exactly this tension. Jordan didn't allow its 1 million refugees to work for very obvious political reasons that Jordan couldn't provide enough jobs for its own citizens. What Alex and I were brought in by a Jordanian think tank and then commissioned by the government, come up with some sensible solutions. And the solution was staring us in the face. It was get European businesses to bring jobs in to Jordan's industrial zones. And those jobs can then be shared between refugees and Jordanian citizens. Once that offer was on the table, the Jordanian government said, let's do it. I was very proud. I was brought in as to represent Jordan, the government of Jordan, in the negotiations with Britain and the World Bank. There were three of us trying to design a viable system. The British government appointed the chief economist of DFID, who happened to be Belgian. The World Bank appointed the chief economist of the Middle East, who happened to be from Sri Lanka. And we sat, the three of us, and we carved out a strategy which was win for Jordan, win for refugees. The Jordanian government said, you do this, we'll give thousand upon thousand of work permit, right? And then the British government got ahead of the curve and said, okay, we've got to try and encourage businesses to take jobs to Jordan. So, for example, Asda, the big supermarket, placed a lot of orders in Jordan, generating jobs, which were then shared between refugees and Jordanians. That model is now called the Jordan model, and it's being applied in Africa. The Ethiopian government's doing it. Chancellor Merkel actually went and visited that scheme just a couple of months ago. I was working with the government of Ethiopia 2 weeks ago that were in Britain, and they're really excited to attract European firms to those zones that can employ refugees and local Ethiopians. That's where we should be putting our energies.
And what about the worry that that gives a sort of permanence? It makes people never want to go back. I mean, as you say, it's incredibly difficult for people to go back, and these conflicts last much longer than anyone imagines. But that, you know, if you're a Jordanian who has some scepticism about how many refugees should be allowed in and so on, you might think, well, these people will make a life here. They'll never go home.
Well, we need to recognise the reality, which is that people are not going home anytime soon. They're getting stuck in limbo. And that's bad for the host government. It's bad for refugees. So we need to adapt to that. But we also have to recognise that if we empower people in the short term, if we give them jobs, if we give them freedoms, they'll be in a stronger position to ultimately go home. They'll be in a better position to contribute to rebuilding post-conflict societies. So when the conflict ends in Syria, for instance, refugees will be able to go back, having not been stagnant, having not had their skills eroded, but being able to actually contribute. And simultaneously, some of the businesses, whether set up by refugees or multinational corporations that were previously in Damascus but have had to leave, can be incubated so they can be part of that post-conflict reconstruction. So helping people to be self-sufficient and have autonomy while they're in exile is the best way to ultimately empower them to go home, or if for whatever reason they can't go home, to be able to contribute to whichever society they end up being resettled to.
And Kate, this distinction between helping people to stay in the region and to live there and bringing them here, it's partly explains Britain's response, doesn't it? I mean, the government was sort of very upset about the idea that it was shutting the door on the Dub scheme because it felt that it was doing a lot for people who are staying in the region through the kinds of things that Paul is talking about.
Yeah, I mean, that's the explanation that the government gives for its policies on asylum here, which is it doesn't want to create a pull factor, is the phrase that always gets used, a pull factor for people to make the dangerous journey to Britain. And that's the reason they give for not giving the right to work to asylum seekers, for instance, and you know, indeed for some of the low financial provision that asylum seekers get to survive off, things like that. The Dub scheme, that was also cited when they shut down the Dub scheme, that they didn't want to give an incentive to traffickers to bring children across. You do end up with a very difficult situation where there are these children living in terrible, terrible conditions in makeshift camps along the coast of France who were expecting to be able to be brought to safety in Britain and treated with the sort of the care that you would hope very vulnerable unaccompanied children would be treated with, who are now stranded in, and there are reports of all sorts of horrific conditions of, you know, children being forced to prostitute themselves, things like that, in order to survive. So, it might be that pull factor, it's too late for these children. These children were already there and hoping to be brought over. So it's not quite the same situation, I think.
Paul, what do you think about that? What do we do with refugees who have made their way as far as the coast of Europe?
Well, we have to have a system which doesn't encourage people to send unaccompanied children here. Clearly, once they're in this limbo world, we have to do something about it. But you know, there are 20 million refugees. There are 65 million displaced. Let's focus primarily on things that work for the millions, because if we focus on the millions, it's actually a fixable problem. It's not of a scale that is unmanageable. If we just keep focusing on 350 kids, we will never pan back to get the political energy to change the damn system that produced those 350 kids. It's the system that is absolutely, tragically out of date. It's 60 years out of date, and it needs fixing. It will only be fixed if people get up to speed with the real possibilities and pressure politicians to change.
Let's talk about the international system a bit, because certainly thinking in terms of the domestic political argument here, for example, the fact that Europe or the EU as an institution appeared to be unable to tackle what was happening, you know, fed into discussions here, even potentially fed into the Brexit vote, some people would argue. Why have the global institutions that we've got seem completely unable to tackle this problem in a kind of rational way?
Well, there are two sets of institutions that matter. There's the sort of global level and then there's the regional European level. At the global level, most of the system we have, the 1951 Refugee Convention and the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, were created in the aftermath of the Second World War. And for the most part, they are stuck in a time warp, and they're not adapted to a very changed world from the world in which they were born. For instance, the Refugee Convention defines refugees as fleeing persecution. They were essentially defined as people who were fleeing a government out to get them. And courts have had to shoehorn changing circumstances into the language of the 1951 convention. And today, most people are not fleeing just tyrannical governments. They're fleeing fragile states. 50% of the world's refugees are coming from Syria, Somalia, and Afghanistan. And so we end up with a situation where different governments make idiosyncratic decisions. If you're an Eritrean, you have a 24% chance of being recognized as a refugee in France and 100% chance of being recognized in Sweden. That inconsistency highlights how outdated that model is. The UN Refugee Agency, meanwhile, is working on a basis where it's very good at a couple of things. It's very good at providing legal advice to governments, which, for the most part, they're ignoring. Most governments are not complying with the 51 Convention. And it's very good at providing care and maintenance, mainly in camps. It struggles to provide support in urban environments, and it struggles with the key skills that are needed today. Political leadership, political analysis to provide a vision, and economic analysis and development to provide jobs. It's not a job agency. It's working more and more with the World Bank, but it has to do more. At the regional level, the European Union is struggling because the Dublin system, which is the cornerstone of the EU model, which allocates responsibility to the frontline states, Italy, Greece, saying the first arrival country is the country that has responsibility for asylum seekers and refugees. That's failing because it was designed for small numbers, not large numbers, and a Europe of 28 can't come up with a new sensible deal.
In which case do we need to dismantle it? I mean, UNHCR, for example, is it the UN's refugee agency? Can it be reformed to tackle this?
The phrase that Alex used, we are not a job agency, UNHCR actually used with us. We're just quoting what they said. The trouble is, what refugees most want is a jobs agency. So here's the choices. You can either radically update, rejig UNHCR, or you can shift the responsibility for jobs for refugees to another agency. The sensible thing, I think, is to do both. The real reason why UNHCR has been so disastrous is that it's had a monopoly on the refugee issue. Literally, in the UN system, if it had the label refugee, it had to
go
to
UNHCR. Yeah.
The World Bank was completely out of this space. I used to work for the World Bank as director of research. When we were working on Jordan, I went to the World Bank and said, "Where are you? You're missing in action." They said, "Oh, we can't do anything in Jordan. It's an upper-middle-income country. We don't operate in upper-middle-income countries." A million refugees, desperate. So we suggested, why don't you take it to the board of the World Bank and see if you can authorize it? To their credit, they did. And the World Bank board unanimously endorsed a change of policy. In October, they issued their first refugee loan. It was for the government of Jordan, and it was to create jobs for refugees in the industrial zones. At the same time, they did something for education in Lebanon for refugees. So it's possible for the economic agencies to move into that space.
And it's about thinking of it more as an economic development problem.
Yes.
UNHCR's, rather than a temporary humanitarian problem.
UNHCR's got to lower the sign that says, "Keep off our turf." They've also got to change their staffing. They're full of lawyers. They need somebody who's got a Rolodex of business. You know, the key decisions are going to have to shift out of courtrooms, which deal with refugees one at a time, into boardrooms where people can generate thousands of jobs each decision.
Create a beautiful website or online store with an award-winning template from Squarespace. Head to squarespace.com and enter the offer code POLITICSWEEKLY to get 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. Squarespace. Make your next move. Make your next website.
Kate, you're thinking about and working with people who are writing about people who've made it to Europe or made it to the UK at the moment. They don't have many of those rights that we've been talking about, the sort of socioeconomic rights of making your own way in the world, building a life for yourself, making a living, those kinds of things.
Yeah, I think it's important to say that these solutions to the enormous global issues that are going on with refugees are worth thinking about in a, you know, pulling back and looking with a broad lens. But there are very concrete things that the British government could be doing. There's a lot that could be reformed here at home in terms of treatment of asylum seekers and refugees. So for asylum seekers who arrive in Britain, at that point they don't have refugee status. So they'll arrive and they'll apply for asylum. And during that time, They are provided with some with money. It's £36.95 a week per person, and that's to cover everything apart from their rent and their bills. So they're provided with a house. It's not a council house. That's often a criticism that people feel hardly done by, because they're on a waiting list for a council house, and why do asylum seekers get it? They don't. They're in a privately managed property from a company like G4S or Serco. The children are allowed to go to school. Adults aren't allowed to work. And that's often something they really find difficult. It means that if their claim takes a while, and some do, many will wait sort of years before their decision eventually gets granted. They're out of the sort of the labour market for that time, feeling they can't contribute. There are issues, of course, that could change. There was a recent Home Affairs Select Committee report into asylum accommodation, which said standards were often appalling and disgraceful, with the words that were used, with rats and bed bugs and inadequate provision for pregnant women, for example, people with young children, victims of torture not feeling safe, being housed with, victims of rape being housed in properties with many other people, like lots of issues that can and should be reformed. Yvette Cooper, who's the chair of that committee, called for an overhaul of the system. It sort of needs rethinking. So we have an obligation, I think, as a country too, and the government has an obligation to those who are here, to treat them with dignity and respect, as well as looking at these broader issues and what you do on a sort of macro level.
And Alexander, partly what we need is a different kind of conversation about this, isn't it? A different kind of public debate about it. Is that part of the problem?
I think so, absolutely. The narrative is wrong, whether it's here or globally. We tend to think of refugees as inevitably dependent, as passive victims. But they don't have to be. Rather than just focusing on their vulnerabilities, we should focus on their capacities. They often have skills, talents, aspirations, and they can help themselves and their communities if we let them. But to do that, we have to recognise that it isn't just about handouts. It's about handshakes. It's about creating entrepreneurship opportunities. It's about creating enabling environments where people can flourish. In a lot of the data we've collected in East Africa, but it applies equally here, we've found that refugees are not reliant for social protection on international agencies. They go to their neighbours, they go to their friends, they go to their communities. They're not dependent on food assistance. You can't live on World Food Programme rations. They provide their own sources of income, and if they can't have them, they go to remittances, they go to family, they go to networks. So we need to shift from a message of vulnerability to one of capacities and one of empowerment.
Paul, how do we have that kind of conversation, given that a lot of politicians here, across the spectrum really, interpreted last summer's referendum result as a decision to have less migration? There's a risk, isn't there, that economic migration, or the worries people have about that, is elided with the idea of giving refugees.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's a great danger of just having a mushy fuzz in the middle of refugees and migrants. The refugee problem is entirely fixable, but it needs a change in the narrative, which will then drive a change in the political decisions. In order to do that, that's why we've written the book Refuge. We need ambassadors. That's why we're here. Over to you.
Well, and hopefully over to hearing the voices of some of those people. Kate, isn't that part of what you're trying to do?
Absolutely, yeah. We're working with a newspaper in Germany, in France, in Spain. Each of us are following new arrivals to these countries who've come in the wave of migration or the refugee crisis of the last year or two. And hearing their voices is extremely important, hearing what it is that they need. And I think we've certainly encountered that illusion of refuge and asylum being lumped in together with a frustration about immigration more generally. One gentleman we talked to in Derby, which is where our family that we're following is based, we asked him what he thought of refugees, and he said, well, those who come and they work, they're fine, but those who come and they bludge off the dollar, we need to send them back. And I said, what countries are they coming from, these refugees? And he said, Poland and Romania. And he just completely conflated the issues. I mean, it happens all the time. The idea that Brexit, shutting the door to immigration that might possibly, who knows, come from Brexit, would have an effect on refugees coming from Syria, from Afghanistan, from Iran, from Iraq, is sort of bonkers, really.
Mm. It is, but those two things get, you know, very much mixed up in the in the public.
But also, let's not forget, most refugees don't want to come to Europe. They want to work in the haven countries, and they dream of going back home when the conflict's over. As Alex says, maybe they'll be able to go back home, taking their jobs with them. Maybe they'll stay permanently in the haven countries. What they're missing, first and foremost, is jobs. And what we can do, first and foremost, is not take a few more or a few less. It's generate the jobs that Jordan itself cannot generate, that Ethiopia itself cannot generate. It's our businesses that need to become engaged, and our NGOs need to marry up with business and say, stop sending blankets, start sending jobs.
Is that quite difficult for some NGOs who, some of whom at least traditionally would have a bit of a suspicion of private sector involvement or of that kind of approach? Is that part of the problem too?
A lot of NGOs now have really woken up to this. I mean, look at one, Bob Geldof. What's Bob's news today? What's he in the headlines for today? His private equity firm is investing big time in Africa. Why is he doing that? Not to make a million for himself. He's already got a million. He's creating job opportunities in Africa. So a lot of NGOs now get it. The ones that don't get it need to get into the 21st century.
What's your worry if this is not grasped at that? I mean, you've talked about really good examples of particular individual cases and success stories. What's your worry if the system doesn't change and it continues to appear to be overwhelmed?
If we don't adapt and update, the challenge that we saw in 2015, 2016, with hundreds of thousands coming to Europe and the disorder that ensues, will happen again. Migration is here to stay. Forced displacement is going to grow, including with climate change, fragile states. We have to have solutions that are sustainable at scale. And the only realistic way to do that is to get the system in order, ensure that we see it as a development opportunity in the main haven countries, in the countries that host 90% of the world's refugees. Most are in developing regions. They're not coming to Europe. Unless we get it right at that level, in a way that works for countries under huge pressure, huge stress, Lebanon, Turkey, Jordan, Kenya, Uganda, the whole system will collapse and we will have disorder and significant levels of onward movement beyond what we saw in 2015. So we're at a turning point and we have to get the institutions right nationally and globally.
I think that's quite a nice note on which to end. You can find more reporting and analysis about these issues on theguardian.com. My thanks to Paul Collier, Alexander Betts and Kate Lyons. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Heather Stewart. Thanks for listening.